We're here for Making Sense of Climate Change. And now I'll introduce Ben. Ben was a missionary kid in Singapore and Malaysia, and he's earned his environmental biology degree from Wheaton College in Chicago, and currently works for the Evangelical Environmental Network, Young Evangelicals of Climate Action, and the Al Sable Institute for Environmental Studies. Please join me in welcoming Ben.
Thanks. Give your mouthful. Good afternoon. It's good to see all of you. I'm actually quite impressed that all of you wanted to spend your afternoon talking about an issue as controversial in some circles as climate change. How many of you, and it's too big a group, so it's going to be hard for me to get a sense of who you are and why you're here. So maybe with a show of hands, how many of you come from churches where you've heard talk about where climate change has been discussed, whether positively or negatively? How many of you come from churches where this topic was covered in some way? All right. How many of you come from schools where this topic was covered in a Christian context, whether you're at a Christian school or an university chapter? How many of you? All right. Well, we're doing a lot better. Now, of course, I don't know the nature of those conversations. They could have all been pretty rough. But like I was introduced, I'm a missionary kid from Singapore and Malaysia. My family was with OMF, Overseas Missionary Fellowship. You heard from our executive director or our international director this morning. We're no longer with them. My dad's a pastor in Boston, but I grew up in the evangelical church. And my parents have always been in ministry, and so I've always been in the church. And I could share my story, which would be too long for now, but I did want to say that when I was in college at Wheaton, I majored in environmental biology. It was kind of an accident, but it was an accident I'm very grateful for, and that's what I graduated with. But as an environmental biology major, it was not until the beginning of my senior year, or really the summer in between my junior and my senior year, that I thought seriously about climate change. Up till that point, I had mostly ignored the topic, because in my circles, it was political, it was partisan, it was controversial, it was polarizing, and it really didn't have very much directly to do with the gospel or the Bible or what it means to be a disciple or a witness to Jesus Christ today. That was my context. And so, like any good pastor's kid, I avoided all the conflict that I could possibly avoid, and I just basically didn't think or deal with climate change until something happened in between my junior and my senior year that forced me to face up to this issue. I don't know where you all are at in your story and your journey, especially as it relates to climate change, but I want to share a little bit about how I came to care about this and then go on to talk more about the issues and where we're at today in the hopes that you might be able to connect with some part or some aspect of my journey. So if we could go to the next slide. It all happened in between my junior and my senior year. I got an NSF grant to be part of a research project on Lake Tanganyika in Tanzania. Have any of you been to Lake Tanganyika? Wow. Okay. I was in Kigoma. That was the town I was based out of. And we were part of a long-term fisheries project and limnology project that was going on Lake Tanganyika. So for the rest of you, Lake Tanganyika is the second deepest lake in the world after Baikal. Yep. Crater Lake's pretty deep, but not quite as deep as these two lakes. Lake Tanganyika is somewhat like a finger lake. It's a rift valley lake. It holds up to 18% of the world's available fresh water at any one given time. That's how big it is. Four countries surround Lake Tanganyika. It contains about 500 species that are found in no other lake in the world, 500 endemic species, over 200 of which are fish, mostly cichlids. So if some of you have aquariums at home, maybe you have cichlids, and some of them might come from the African Great Lakes region. And Lake Tanganyika is also, so some of the countries surrounding Lake Tanganyika include not just Tanzania, which is where I was based, but Burundi and the DR Congo. Those two countries in particular have been through a lot of political strife and conflict and war over the years, and there's been a lot of refugee movement around the lake. And a lot of it has ended up, and a lot of the refugees have ended up in camps around Kigoma, where I went. The really valuable part of Lake Tanganyika is the ecosystem resources that it provides to their surrounding communities. So fresh water, transportation, being able to go up and down the lake by boats to get from village to village, fresh water for drinking and for cleaning and for all the other things that we need it for. And then fishing. Fishing is a very important activity. It provides a primary source of protein for a lot of people in the area, and also a primary source of livelihood or income. Now, the problem is, over the years, over the recent years, the fishery on Lake Tanganyika has been declining, and the declines have been getting worse and worse over time. People just aren't finding the fish, and they aren't catching the fish, and the fish are smaller when they do find them overall. And this has a lot of people concerned. And so an international research team was assembled and had been studying this lake for a number of years, and I came onto it after a lot of data was already collected, but they found something that was very interesting. And I had no framework for understanding this before I went to Lake Tanganyika, which is that climate change was having a negative impact. Climate change was a major factor behind the decline in the fishery on Lake Tanganyika. And here's how it all happened. I'm going to try to explain this. And I know I can't do it in Swahili, but I'll try to do it in English. I'm not sure I'll do very much better. But Lake Tanganyika is very deep, long, and narrow. All of the oxygen is in the surface level of the lake. All the nutrients are in the depths of the lake, but there is no oxygen there. And so what happens, in order to sustain a fishery, you need to have nutrients and oxygen where the ecosystem, the food web, can be based out of. It's the base of the food web. It's where the primary productivity comes. Then you have the algae that grows, and then the little critters that eat the algae, and then the little fish that eat the little critters, and then the big fish that eat the little fish, and you get the idea. So that happens at the surface level. Lots of oxygen, very poor, very low nutrient. The water is clear. You can see 30, 40 feet down and just rock cliffs that disappear. It's a really neat place to go snorkeling and scuba diving. But not if you have explosive diarrhea, as I found. I got Giardia and I got malaria at the same time. And I don't know if ever any of you have tried. Well, I hope you didn't try, but I don't know if any of you have had diarrhea when you were wearing a wetsuit 30 feet underwater, but there's no easy or clean way to do that. But what they had found is there had been a regional warming in air temperatures that corresponds to the global changes that we're measuring around the world today. And let me step back. I forgot to mention one thing. The reason this ecosystem works, the reason the fishery is so robust, is because just about every year, seasonal winds will blow across the lake. And what they will do is they'll start to stack water up on one end, and they'll start to generate these huge upwelling currents in the lake. It happens in Lake Michigan. I'm from Chicago. And every once in a while, we'll have sustained winds blowing long and strong enough that they'll actually back water. So it looks like a tide in Chicago, but it's really not. It's because of wind. It's wind-driven, not moon-driven. And so it will back the water up, and it'll cause these upwelling cycles to take place in the lake, which will bring nutrient-rich water from the depths up into the surface, which is where the oxygen is, and that's how the fishery is sustained so well. Otherwise, you'd have much fewer fish in the lake, and the fishery would be much less productive. Well, what's happening is we're measuring a warming of the air that's causing the seasonal winds to decrease and become more intermittent. So the energy that will provide for the mixing is not always there, and when it's there, it's not always strong enough to generate that same amount of mixing. And on top of that, what we're seeing is the warming of the air start to translate slowly over time, there's a lag, into a warming of the water column, and at least the surface levels of the water column, which makes the surface levels, so the water column is stratified into different layers. And the surface layers get warmer, and the depths stay cooler, and it makes it harder for those two to actually ever mix. So we see two things going on. There's no energy for mixing, and it takes more energy to even mix what there is. And over time, the same people fishing in the same ways are causing the fishery to decline when otherwise it would have been a sustainable fishery resource. And it all comes back to climate change. Now, I think I did better than I sometimes do explaining that to you. I hope it makes sense. But I was on a fishing beach one morning in between bouts of malaria fever. And my job was to wake up early in the morning, which is something else I'm not good at, and go down to the fishing beaches and wait for the fishermen to paddle their dugout canoes. And I love canoeing, but a dugout canoe is a whole different ballgame. That is heavy, and I don't know how to use it. It's something else. But they paddle the dugout canoes in with their catch, and I sort through the catch with them on the beach before they sell it to figure out what they're catching, the species, the abundance, the size, and we're just collecting data on the health of the fishery. And I was doing that with one of the fishermen that I got to know over time, and he asked, why am I not catching the fish that we always used to catch? my family has fished this lake for generations. And I thought, oh, I have an answer for him. I know this one. So I jumped in and I started explaining climate change. And of course, I couldn't do it in Swahili. And I was trying to do it in English. And he was very patient, but he gave me about 5 minutes. And, you know, the fish are there and they need to be sold. And so he finally said, okay, never mind. What do I need to do to fix it? And when he asked me that question, I didn't have an answer. Because I realized very quickly that there was only so much that he would ever be able to do to fix this problem. And there was only so much that he was even contributing to the problem in the first place. But what God did for me in that moment is I felt very strongly convicted that when I returned to the United States, I couldn't just push this issue off to the side anymore. I couldn't say, this is controversial, so I just don't want to deal with it, or this is political, so it's not something for the church to engage in. I couldn't pretend it didn't exist because I saw it happening in front of my very eyes and I saw it impacting my neighbor around the world. And it was a justice issue because a lot of the people around the world who have done the least to cause the changes that we're seeing are being impacted the most negatively and have the least resources to adapt to the changes that we're experiencing in the world today. That's not us. We'll feel impacts, we already do, but in the U.S., we tend to have more resources. Our governments tend to have more money, whether or not politically you like the tax rate is another thing. But we are more able to adapt and respond when natural disasters hit or when droughts are extended or when hurricanes go further into the Atlantic and hit parts of New England that they usually don't hit at the strength that the Superstorm Sandy hit New England where my parents live. We can adapt. But the man I was talking to in his dugout canoe on the shores of Lake Tanganyika, what else does he do? His family was originally, I found out, from Burundi, but they fled around the lake to Kigoma because of the conflict there, and Burundi was a little more stable for a while, but right now Burundi's again in a lot of chaos and a lot of violence. What does he do? But I knew what I had to do, and that was I couldn't keep quiet when I came back, and I had to get serious about this issue as a Christian. It's not just a justice issue, it's a health issue. It's about human life and health. And you know, the Christian community in the U.S., the evangelical community in particular that I'm from, we make a big deal a lot of time about how we're pro-life, but often that only means that we're anti-abortion. And I don't mean to get into what's a very tough issue, but all I want to do is say, look, if we're really going to be pro-life, if we're going to care about human life and the sanctity of that life that God has given us, then we have to care about all the threats to life, not just things like abortion, but also climate change and environmental degradation and pollution, which are very real for many people around the world. So that's what I learned on the shores of Lake Tanganyika, and I came back to the U.S. and I started to read more and study more and get involved more, and I found out that I wasn't alone, and there are many other Christians and people in the church who are starting to wake up to this issue and how we need to catch up. And a lot of the work I do today, so I work for Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. The Evangelical Environmental Network is our sponsor ministry. And we're part of the National Association of Evangelicals, the NAE, if you want to follow all of that. But you'd think that I would be mostly working with environmental organizations. So maybe groups like the Sierra Club or groups like the National Wildlife Federation. You know who I work with more often than anything these days? Christian relief and development organizations. Groups like World Vision, Food for the Hungry, Tear Fund in the UK, because in the words of one of their executives, climate change has become one of the gravest threats or gravest challenges to the work of relief and development around the world because it's undoing the progress they've been able to make to get access to clean water, healthy food, and stable ecosystems in which to build and sustain their communities. Climate change has become a threat to relief and development. And I work increasingly with mission agencies and organizations. I'm an OMF missionary kid. Well, OMF now has a dedicated full-time staff person who's coordinating their creation care missions work, which is a new but expanding field that I'll talk about at a seminar this time tomorrow. And actually, right here in the front row, we have Ben Batchelor, who's a representative for TEAM, which has a table down in the display hall. And his full-time job with TEAM is to help to coordinate their creation care missions work around the world. And so this is growing, and that's a good thing because it really needs to grow. Can we go to the next slide? we took a, with Tier Fund, I want to give you one example of something that we did a few years back. We partnered with them and went to the nation of Malawi in Africa, and we worked with the local evangelical church in Malawi to look at the impacts that climate change is already having on their communities. And there, a lot of the communities we visited were agrarian communities, so they farm millet, sorghum, maize, ideally, but more drought-resistant crops like millet and sorghum and cotton. And we went to see the impacts that climate change was having on their communities on one hand, but we also went to see the good news of what their communities were doing to respond and the solutions that they were pursuing, the new innovative things that they were doing to adapt and prepare for the changes that they're experiencing. And what we did is we took a group from the U.S., a bunch of church leaders from around this country, and we took them out of this political context, you know, this really polarized context, and brought them over there where we could just have honest conversations with fellow Christians from around the world about what is going on without all the political baggage that we have to deal with here sometimes. And that was a really valuable trip. And the folks came back, and it's been a long-term relationship that has been built. On the left, if I can see it right, on the left, they were showing us some of the, they started a tree nursery because they had been deforesting the area for fuel and wood for building and things like that. But they realize how important trees are to the local climate, the microclimate, as well as to the overall environment. And so they started a tree nursery, and that was the nursery they're showing us where they have the saplings shaded from the heat of the sun. And then they also then took us to a forest. And we stood in the middle of the forest, and we looked around, and they said, "We planted all these trees." And it was a full-grown forest when we were there. It was really encouraging to see what they were doing. And then on the right side, your right side, the other picture, this was discouraging. We went walking down or running down what they told us was used to be their river, which is dry now most of the time. They told us we had banana trees on the banks. We had fish that we would catch out of this river all year round. And now it's dry. And when it flows, the only time it flows is when the torrential rains come. And then it floods, and it overflows the banks, and it threatens the village, and it's washed away people and homes before. So what they've been doing is they've been building the banks up. They've been building these levees to keep the flood waters in when it does flow. But we're actually standing on the bed of the river there. And there we saw the bad news of what climate change is doing around the world to disrupt the lifestyles that we've built in this world. But we also saw the good news of what Christians can do and what communities can do when we don't run away from the issue, but when we face it and when we work together to find creative solutions. Can we go to the next slide, please? Oh, I just wanted to show this to you. Because as a missionary kid, we have a saying, where he leads me, I will follow. What he feeds me, I will swallow. Nah, there was not a chance. Those are field mice on the ends of sticks, the street food, you know, you're driving by and they're like, they had little birds too, little sparrows that were on the ends of sticks. Anyway, you can go to the next slide. So it's not just the church overseas that has taken this more seriously, it's also the church in the United States. And the Lausanne movement in 2010, the Lausanne movement was founded by Billy Graham and John Stott a number of decades ago now. And it was focused on world evangelization and world missions. And every number of years, it will have a big global congress where representatives from churches all around the world will meet together to talk about what the challenges are to evangelization today and what the opportunities are and plan a strategy forward. So they met last as a global congress in 2010 in Cape Town, South Africa, and they came up with the Lausanne Cape Town Commitment, which was a rearticulation of the mission of the church today. And a number of years later, actually just a few months ago, this year, 2015, the National Association of Evangelicals, which represents over 30 million Christians in the U.S., a number of denominations, including the one I'm part of, the CMA, they adopted the Lausanne's message, the Lausanne's wording on creation, care, and climate change. And you can read it on the screen there, too. I can't quite read it from here, but you can see it. And a very encouraging step forward, because the United States is absolutely critical to get on board in these conversations, and we've been the ones who have been lagging the most. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with brothers and sisters from around the world who say, we are suffering because of environmental degradation, unsustainable development, and the early impacts of climate change. And we turn to our brothers and sisters in the US who are causing a lot of the pollution that's going around the world, and you don't believe that our problems are real. You're not even willing to accept that we're facing these challenges. And so it's very encouraging that the US church is starting to step up and take this seriously. So I want to talk a little bit about what needs to happen. What's the path forward? There's a lot of bad news, and I don't want to leave you with that. But there are three broad categories that we can talk about. The first is adaptation or preparation. We're experiencing impacts. We're committed to experiencing more impacts, even if we stopped further climate change today. And climate change is a natural phenomenon, right? The climate has always changed, and it's always changing. And that in and of itself is not a moral issue. That's not a good or a bad. The problem is that the climate is changing and is being disrupted now partly by human activity in ways that makes our lifestyles problematic. We now have a lot more people in the world than we've ever had before, and we live in very sensitive parts of the world. And so when rains don't come, or when too many rains do come, and the rivers overflow their banks, as you can go out and see, that's a problem right now. That becomes a human and a moral problem. So preparation, adaptation means what are we doing to get ready for and prepare for the impacts that we are already experiencing? And there's a lot going on there. That's building the dikes and the levees, and that's relocating people from floodplains, and that's coming up with stronger building shelters that can withstand stronger storms and more sustained winds, and that's trying to figure out how to help the folks around Lake Tanganyika fish sustainably and then diversify their livelihoods with something else, because the fishery is declining. So that's preparation and adaptation. The second is mitigation. What do we do to keep further climate change from happening? And so what do we do to reduce the amount of climate pollution or carbon pollution? There are other pollutants in the atmosphere cause climate change besides carbon dioxide, but a lot of it's translated and then measured in terms of carbon. So carbon pollution or carbon equivalent pollution. What do we do to reduce the amount of pollution that we're putting up into the atmosphere? A lot of that has to do with clean energy. It has to do with energy efficiency. And then the third category that we're working on is innovation and investment. This is really important. We already have a lot of the solutions we need. If we were to apply all the solutions that we currently have, we could solve this problem. But it's still challenging, and there is still a cost to bear. So one of the things that we do need to do is we need to invest in clean energy innovation so that we can have better, more effective, more efficient solutions. So one of the big things right now for renewable energy, especially solar and wind, is we need a way to store the energy. We need a battery that will store the energy when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing. Because if not, what you risk doing now is you throw up all of these wind turbines and all of these solar panels, but then you also have to throw up all these natural gas plants or keep all these coal plants running, so that when all those things aren't available, you can power these guys up, except you can't just power them up from scratch. They have to be already running at a certain level. So you're still producing a lot of pollution, and so we need to figure this. We have a lot of gaps that we need to figure out, and that's why we need to heavily invest in innovation and investment, and companies like Tesla are very exciting because they're doing just that, and Bill Gates just announced huge investment in clean energy, and so we're moving forward in these directions. Next slide, please. So you might be aware of COP21 Paris. I'm not going to dwell on it very much now. If you want, you can ask questions later. I wasn't actually there. I didn't think it made sense for me to fly all the way over there unless I had a particular role to play. And celebrity sighting wasn't worth it. So I stayed back and watched the news like some of you might have been doing. And there's lots of opinions on how successful Paris was and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing or a waste of time or a productive thing. And I'll tell you this. From my perspective, overall, I'm very encouraged by Paris. I think it marks a turning point. No, it's not the end of it's not the solution, and it's not going to get us to where we need to get. But the world did come together, and we did agree, theoretically, to limit climate change, limit the warming to significantly under 2 degrees Celsius, with a goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is more ambitious than we've been able to be so far as a global community. And we did, all the countries did bring different plans to the table, contributions that they will make that won't actually get us there. So we have to go further, but it's more than we've accomplished so far, and I think that's worth celebrating too. But I'll tell you this, overall, I'm encouraged. I've been doing this work now for almost a decade, which isn't that long for some people. For me, it's a third of my life I've been doing this work. And I haven't always been encouraged, but I am now, because we have built up so much momentum. Since I've started in this, you can see the developments that have happened, the momentum we've built. The International Energy Agency, the IEA, projects that by 2050, the leading source of electricity power generation in the world today will be solar. And that's not because of government mandates. That's just because of the markets and the technology and where things are headed. So I'm really encouraged. The reports that we see today coming out, the studies being done, say that we've built so much momentum in transitioning to a clean energy future that it's unstoppable. In other words, we're going to solve climate change. We will get there. So I'm really encouraged. The question, the remaining questions for me, the twofold questions are, first, how long will it take us to get to where we need to be in that clean energy future? And who's going to get left behind in the process? And that, I believe, is the strategic role that we as Christians can bring, is building a moral movement, building a voice, advocating to help move that transition along, to speed that transition up in ways that just economics won't do on its own, but seeing these and understanding these issues as moral issues and using that language to encourage people to live up to who we're called to be and to move those transitions along faster than they would otherwise. And then to pay attention to the people who are being left behind, whether that's the fishermen that I talked to on Lake Tanganyika in East Africa, or whether it's communities in Appalachia who have for generations been dependent on the coal industry, but the coal industry is dying and it's leaving. Regardless of what we do about climate change, the coal industry is on its way out. And so what do we do about those communities? They matter too, and we need to help everybody make this transition into the clean energy future. And those are two things I think we as Christians can do. Now, I want to leave you one practical opportunity for you to engage and follow up. The group that I work with, Young Evangelicals for Climate Action, you have to be 30 and under to count as a young evangelical. And just full disclosure, I just turned 31. So I'm actually transitioning out of YECA, but we've got great new leadership in, and that's a great group that you can be part of and you can get involved in if you like. We're going to show a quick video right now, and then I'll talk through some resources and we'll do questions. There'll be a list of resources up on the screen now. The first, it's a bit of a long link for you, but you can also just go to the NAE's website, the National Association of Evangelical, and search for the booklet itself, Loving the Least of These. It comes in the form of a downloadable PDF, or you can order print copies. And it's a publication that they put together approaching climate change from a Christian perspective and explaining it and talking about what the church is doing to engage. So that's a very helpful thing. I've got a couple books that are available in the IVP bookstore downstairs. Also, the three websites for you. The bottom one is Young Evangelicals for Climate Action's website. The second up from the bottom, the IPCC, is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's the international body responsible for pulling together and compiling all the climate science out there and then evaluating it and publishing a synthesis. Their stuff is very meaty if you want to go to the original stuff. The original science. But if you're looking for something that will be much more user-friendly for folks, especially if you're not interested in the in-depth science of it all, skepticalscience.com is run by an evangelical Christian based out of Australia, but it answers a lot of common questions, and it provides you different levels of answers. So if you want the elevator pitch version, the two-minute version, here's a quick and dirty answer. If you want to go a little bit deeper, if you want a full answer with citations, you can do that. It's a very, very helpful website to answer a lot of questions. I use it as a resource a lot myself. So I think what I'd like to do now is I'd like to take a couple minutes, and if you would just turn to the person next to you, groups of two, three, informal, and talk about one question that you might have. What has this generated in you? Question you might have about climate change that you'd like to discuss, or one takeaway that you've heard so far from the talk, okay? So a question or a takeaway. We'll take a couple minutes, and then we'll come back, and I'd love to hear what some of those are. Let's come back together. Sorry to cut your conversation short so quickly. I'm sure we could talk a lot longer. It'd be interesting, though, to hear what you've been talking about. So anybody would like to start us off? Any questions you have in particular or any points that you'd like to make or takeaways? Yeah. Yeah.
To the mic so that it, because this is being recorded, so that the person hearing the recording can hear you. So please talk into the mic. Thank you.
Should I stand up? So what kind of concise argument would you provide for somebody who, to talk to somebody who has sort of that conservative political background or whatever might make someone not embrace the idea of climate change as being real? How would you kind of convince them that that's actually a thing?
Thanks. What's your name?
I'm Joshua.
Joshua, thanks. If you could remember to say your name, if not, I'll ask you, but thanks, Joshua. I'm sorry I won't be able to answer your question very concisely because it really depends on where people are coming from. I think, you know, knowing your audience is very important. So, for instance, I come from a family that has very Republican, always ever only voted Republican. So it's really important for me to know that and to be able to talk to them about how, you know, this isn't a left versus right or Republican versus Democratic issue. It's become that in this country in some sense. But at the end of the day, it's a moral issue. And for us, it's a biblical issue. We're called to love our neighbor. And if our neighbor is being impacted by climate change, then we have to do something about it. So that's how I would start, by knowing the person I'm talking to, so knowing what their concerns are, what I have to address, and identifying some common ground. So that would be relating to each other on our common faith, you know, the Bible, Scripture. I found talking about climate impacts is a lot more helpful for folks than talking about the causes of climate change, because some people aren't very comfortable yet thinking that humans are playing a significant role in causing the current changes we're measuring in the climate, but they're willing to accept that the climate is changing and that's having impacts on communities today in the form of more floods or less rainfall and droughts and stuff like that. So talking about impacts is one way to get around some of the tougher issues and to begin a conversation. And the other thing I would end by saying, and one could say a lot here, I'm sure you could all add a lot from your experiences, is to be very patient, to be very humble, and to give it lots of time. We're all on journeys, and I'm sure I'm pig-headed on something or another. And so allowing the Holy Spirit to work in our lives and in the lives of the people we're trying to be in community with around this issue takes time sometimes. But thanks for your question. Was there a question up here?
My question is, like, I work for an environmental company in Canada doing remediation and reclamation work, and we sort of go through, like, a site-by-site basis. Is that enough, or are we needing more of an environmental government and policymaking that is more broader strokes in trying to control this? So I'm just kind of wondering, like, what is needed? Is it good enough to just do a site-by-site, or do we need more policy?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, right? If yeah. I'm reading it right. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for the work that you do in Canada. It's not work that I get to do. I feel like a lot of times my work is very big picture, and I really would like to, I miss being able to just get my hands dirty on a project and see the difference that I'm making in cleaning up a particular site. That's very rewarding, but I also think this is important, the advocacy or the political work as well. And I think the answer to your question is we need to engage on all levels. As Christians, we don't create, you know, partition areas of influence for the gospel and the kingdom. Christ is Lord of all, and so he's Lord over all. And whether that's, so as Christians, we're called to be about what God is about. And that means, and we're also called to faithfulness, which means, this might take more unpacking than I have time for, but at the end of the day, I don't believe, and I hope this is not controversial, I don't believe we're the ones who are called to save the world. I believe we follow the God who is, and we get to partner. God invites us not only to be recipients of the gospel and his saving work, but to be participants in it and agents of it as well. And so whatever he has called you to do, if he has called you to work on that local community level, then bless you, and that's great. And maybe I'll get there one day too, and I'll be able to do some of that work. Or maybe you'll come and do some of the work that I'm doing. But we're called to engage in every level as God calls us and provides us opportunities to do so. So I think it's very important that we do go home and we do, as we are able to, switch off lights and conserve energy and use any energy-efficient light bulbs. But then I think when, you know, Congress in the U.S. or your government, which is taking a much more proactive stance on climate now with the new government in, but let's say Congress in the U.S., when they're debating energy or climate bills, that we write to or call or communicate with our legislators and express our concern and share why we care about this. So I would say it's all of the above. It's a both and. But thanks for your question. There's a question at the back and then at the front next. Thanks.
Hey, thank you for your talk. I'm actually a meteorology graduate student, and my name is Kyle, by the way. So some things I agree with what you said, some things I didn't. I do agree that we need to do stewardship and things of that nature. The science side, you know, I'd love to talk to you about after. My question basically is, though, how do we as meteorologists combine missions, whether it be in this issue or another, for the sake of the gospel?
Well, that's a great question, and I think you're probably the better person to answer it than me. I've never thought about that. That's not an area that I've worked in or have felt called to. So I expect that there are ways that you can serve, and I appreciate the focus that you have in your question, because I believe we're all called to be on mission with God. And sometimes it's easy to think you have to work for a Christian organization, like I work for the Evangelical Environmental Network, so I can do this work as part of my mission. But you can be working for the Sierra Club and be on mission with God, if that's what he's called you to be. You can work as a meteorologist in an agency or whatever it is you might end up doing and be on mission with God. So I'm encouraged by the way you asked the question. I hope you find the way God is leading you to serve in this area. I'm not sure I can answer it, though, in terms of what I would recommend. Sorry, but thanks. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Austin. I was formerly a meteorology student, but like going through for what the first person who asked a question going with, we go on political sides. I think from an economical standpoint, like how you see like the current sources of energy that we use, like oil and gasoline, how much it costs to use that, and compare that to the clean energy. Like you see, the clean energy is a lot more expensive than the current sources that we have. My question to you is, how can we make the clean energy sources a lot more affordable to use than the current sources that we have, without having to raise the prices for the current cheaper source?
Gotcha. And that's a really important question, thank you, because energy prices matter to a lot of people who can't afford to pay more for gas or to pay more for heating oil or whatever the case is. And if you artificially spike prices in order to change behavior, people will be hurt by that action. So I'm not an economist, and this is the problem with this field. It's so vast and it's so deep that you can't possibly be an expert in everything. And what I spend my time doing is talking with Christians about how to start thinking about and reframing this issue. So I'm afraid I'm not an expert in the question you asked, but I would say what I would like to see is I would like all subsidies removed from energy so that we would have a level playing field in this country. We do not. There are tremendous amounts of subsidies on fossil fuels. There are subsidies, increasingly subsidies, on clean energy. And there are also subsidies on the nuclear industry, too. And when you have subsidies like this, you can't make a very informed decision, because the free market doesn't work that way. You have all these hidden costs. We also need to internalize all the external costs of dirty energy sources. What do I mean by external costs? I mean the cost of pollution. Pollution has a cost. Not everybody pays it, but the communities in Appalachia pay the cost of coal mining. When you blow up mountains to get coal out, mountaintop removal mining in Appalachia, communities suffer. Groundwater gets polluted and contaminated. People drink polluted water. And there are places in Appalachia today that we've worked with that are called cancer alleys because of the extremely elevated levels of cancer in that community. That's a cost that is not being factored into the bigger equation, the economic equation. So when we want to sort these energy questions and equations out, we do need to remove the subsidies so that we understand what's going on and then internalize the externalities. I think that will get us a lot further than what we're at right now. But then the other answer, I think, is innovation. Everybody knows BP for a while was calling itself Beyond Petroleum. Everybody knows that we are moving away from fossil fuels in the future. So how we make that transition is the question. But even the fossil fuel industries know what's happening. And maybe if they embrace it, they can help us. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Julian. For those of us on campuses, can you help us think about ways we've ignored or distorted the way the environment is clearly written into the story of Scripture?
Sure. I can recommend, first of all, my first book, Green Revolution, which is focused on that and focuses on students on campuses and ways they can engage to make a difference. But I think a lot, we got to go back to the scriptures. I was raised in the church, as I shared, and I'm amazed at the scriptures that are there that I didn't engage. We spent so much time in Genesis 1 debating origins of the earth and origins of the human species and missed the main point of Genesis. Well, a lot of the main points of Genesis is that creation is created good. That's repeated so many times throughout, which is that humans are created distinct from all the rest of creation in that we are created in the image of God. Everything else is made in its own image. We're made in God's image. In the likeness of God, he created them, male and female, he made them, and it follows. Why did he do that? It follows right there in that passage. And so that they may rule over the fish of the seas and the birds of the air and over the animals and the livestock that crawl on the ground. We were created in the image of God so that we could represent God and being stewards or vice regents or whatever you would like to call it over his creation. And that's we've been missing a lot of that, but it's foundational to the scriptures. And you can take it all the way through. You can look at the giving of the law and the Levitical code. You can look at the prophets. You can look at the Psalms. You can go into the New Testament. You can look at Romans 8 and Colossians 1, 15 through 20, and all the way through to Revelation 22, from creation to renewed creation. And it's a remarkable story that sometimes is a blind spot for us. So it's a big question. I hope I've given you the beginnings of an answer, and there's a lot of good stuff in there. Yeah.
Rachel? My question is basically, how can we, it's somewhat economic, but how can we as consumers educate ourselves on industries that are having a negative environmental impact and also educate ourselves on industries that are having a positive environmental impact? Basically, what should we know that we don't know? And so that, you know, a lot of this issue is that we don't know what we should know. And just curious about how we can educate ourselves as members of the church and also as consumers in the economy and how we can encourage the marketplace to produce products that are encouraging the clean energy and renewable resources, the use of those and sustainable resources and all that.
Thanks, Rachel. That's a really good question and also one that's hard to answer very quickly because it's not easy, right? We want to do the right thing, but often we're stuck in these systems that are created that make it hard. In the U.S. in particular, and the developed world in particular, we're very insulated. Like my friends who are farmers in Malawi, they know what they need from the earth and what they do to the earth because they're in relationship with the earth, and we're not. We go to the supermarket for groceries, and who knows? Even if it says organic or free range, who knows what that really means at the end of the day? A lot of people are out there scamming the system, and so it's not easy. It takes a lot of work. But what I would say, and there are a lot of resources out there to help you in that work. There are a lot of guides and lists and you know, news stories of companies that are being innovative and finding new ways to do things. And you can always think of, so what I would say is to think of it this way. Think of how you can have less of a negative impact and more of a positive impact, and both. It's both. It's really important. Sometimes we think we just want to be less of the curse. But no, we were created to be a blessing. And so what can we do to have less of an environmental footprint and a larger environmental handprint? And then think about it relationally, not as a list of 10 things I need to do this week to care for the environment, but how can I be in right relationship with God, with my neighbor, and with creation by how I consume resources and produce waste and use energy? And a lot of that will become common sense. We'll have to think about it. We'll have to reflect on our lives very prayerfully, but I think we'll see a lot of ways to move forward. So I hope that begins to answer your very good question, but thanks. And there's a question here that's been waiting for a while.
Yeah, my name is Kelton. And so you talked about how it was sort of like the humanitarian link that sort of let you link sort of faith with climate change and that importance. And I guess I'm curious if you think that there's also room for sort of like a biocentric link
Sure.
between faith and climate change and what that looks like.
Yeah, thanks, Kelton. And then there's a question right behind him, too. Okay, thanks. So this is a tension that I feel a lot. If I talk about caring for creation and I link it to caring for people, then it's a lot easier to have that conversation. But that's not the whole conversation, at least not according to the Bible. We're called to care for creation apart from any impact it might have on people, because creation itself is intrinsically good because God made it and declared it so, and we are God's agents in the world today. We do need to work on that. And as a church, while making the case for the impacts that humans are facing because of environmental problems, we have to be careful not to neglect that other part. And that's why I think it's great. I have friends who are studying, who are studying wasps and wasp breeding behavior, and I think, wow, that's a great thing to dedicate your life to if that's what God has called you to. So thanks.
In circles I've been involved with, there's a certain theological bias against sort of environmental, is perhaps coming out of sort of a new age ethos. And I'd put to you, in refining on the question that was asked earlier, what limits scripturally are placed, or would you see placed on the dominion that humanity has on creation?
Sure. And
because I think that if you're getting into that those limits, then yeah. then you've got a theological grounding for the sorts of concerns we have.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry, what's your name? Andy. Thanks, Andy. Dominion's a tough word, isn't it? We've used that a lot of the times. The circles I run in we've used that as an excuse not to be stewards of creation. And that couldn't be further from the truth. Well, I suppose it could be, but you get my point. It's not true. The word dominion, we take and we think rule and subdue. Those are two other words. And we interpret them in ways that give us license to do whatever we want, basically to rape and pillage. But that's not the model that we're given. We are created in the image of God to reflect God's image in how we have dominion. We're reflecting God's image in how we rule and subdue. So we don't have to run away from those words at all. We can embrace them, but we have to remember that those words have taken all sorts of meanings in the world today, and we have to remember what the biblical meaning of those words are. So that said, dominion does include space for discipline. I mean, as humans created in the image of God, I believe that gives us the distinct authority and capacity to make decisions for creation that other species wouldn't be able to do. Ethicists might call that sentience and refer to our level of sentience. But I think that means we get to decide what's a weed and what's not a weed. What's a weed? A weed is a plant that's not in its proper place. But who decides what its proper place is? That's us. So we do have a lot of leeway, and this means it requires us to be in relationship with our Creator God, pursuing and with the best intentions what we believe is right to do. And then I think stewardship is defined by making the right decisions based on the best information we have at that time. God will not, I don't think God will hold us accountable for things that we didn't know about, that we had no way to know. But I do think He expects us to take the information He's given us and to be good stewards of that information. Hope that starts to answer your question. Thanks.
So we have two final questions, and that's all the time we have for today. But the speaker will be available outside if you would like to talk to him further.
Hi, my name is Kimberly, and I know you talked about some of your projects overseas, but I was wondering if you have any specific programs or partnerships that we can do in North America, like just short of being Elon Musk, right, and like doing Tesla and like innovating all of that, like what can we just do in our neighborhoods?
Yeah, thank you, Kimberly, right? I would recommend you check out Young Evangelicals for Climate Action, because that's the group of young people in this country who are on the ground doing things on their campuses and then organizing together in a broader fashion. So check out Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. That said, however, I would suggest you talk to Ben up front here or at the team table. They have a lot of opportunities, including short-term opportunities. And OMF also has a list of opportunities. And I have some of the OMF sheets up front if you want of short-term opportunities. But then there are a lot of other groups. There's an organization that I work with called the Osabo Institute. If you'd like to get further training on a Christian perspective on environmental care and protection, Osabo Institute runs college-level courses for credit on their campuses in the U.S. We have two. And so you can, during the summer, take courses with Osabo that will help build up your skills. There's an organization called Arasha that's a community-based conservation organization. It has a chapter in the U.S. that works on the community level, doing backyard Bible clubs, or doing, they actually work in Nashville, Tennessee with songwriters, and they write creation care-related Christian songs. They put together an album, and they're working on another one. So there's lots of stuff going on, and those are some of the places I would start. Thanks. What's the last question?
My name's Sabrina, and my question is, sometimes in talking with people, they'll be like, well, the issue is so systemic, and even you, this is where you're not doing the best that you could, so it doesn't matter, you know. And I said, well, we're all sinners, and we're not going to be sinless, but that doesn't mean we don't try to not sin. And then it was just like, well, that's just how you're choosing to see things. But I just guess, is there a better response to even in my own failures, like, I still care about this, and it's an important issue, so.
Yeah, Thanks. Well, that's a powerful last question. My second book, Doing Good Without Giving Up, that's a lot of that is trying to answer some of those questions. I believe at the end of the day, we're called to be faithful. God doesn't need more heroes in the world. God isn't looking for more effective people. God is looking for more faithful, obedient people, people who follow after his heart. And so at the end of the day, I think that's what we're all doing. We're on a journey. We're called to be on a journey, headed in the right direction, taking the next step. So we're all works in progress in every area of life, like you pointed out. And just because we're not there yet doesn't mean we're not on the journey, and we're not called to be on that journey if we believe we have the Holy Spirit working in our lives and conforming us to the image of Christ and taking that next step. And maybe this is a good way to end. I would invite you and all of you to think about, and maybe as you talk to the people who ask you these questions, to think about, all right, what's the next step that God is calling me to take? I'm not perfect. We're all learning on the journey together. But then to take that next step, and then to keep asking that question, what's the next step God is calling me to take, and to take that next step, and to keep asking that question, and to keep taking those next steps until the very next step, and we don't know when this will be, but until the very next step brings you before the throne of God. And then by the grace of Jesus Christ, and not because of all the light bulbs we changed in this life, or all the electric cars that we invested in, or all the trees that we planted, but by the grace of Jesus Christ, may all of us, environmental saints and sinners, hear, well done, thou good and faithful servant, now enter into my rest. But we don't stop until then, and we don't give up on God because he hasn't given up on us. So I'll stop there. Thank you all for being here again, and thank you for being so gracious and so hospitable to me. I know this is a big issue, and I know it's a tough issue, and sometimes we come from different perspectives, so I really appreciate the questions and how you ask them, and let's close in prayer so I can pray for you as you leave this time. Father, we thank you. We thank you for your Holy Spirit. We thank you for being here with us, for working in our lives, and for calling us into this journey with you and with each other. And so we trust you with the time that we've shared together and what you've the ways that you are leading us and speaking to us. We trust you to complete the work that you've begun in us. We turn to you for wisdom, and we turn to you for strength. We turn to you for grace. And I ask now in particular that you would bless all those that came to this seminar, that you would walk with them as they leave and throughout their time at Urbana, that you would show them your kingdom and show them the ways that you have created them to be part of that, to be part of caring for your creation and how to even address challenging issues like climate change. Jesus, we look forward to when you come back, to when you make all things new, to when we won't have to wrestle with tough issues like this anymore. But in the meantime, please keep us faithful, not by our power, but by your Spirit. In Jesus' name, amen.